to Air in Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 13th of April 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, it is actually Easter Monday. Christ is risen, and I do have here with me today my co-host Max Musson. Max, good Easter to you. How are you doing? Happy Easter to you, rather. Good, and good afternoon to you. How are you doing?
Ah, very well indeed. Happy Easter to you as well. It's we're benefiting from glorious sunny weather, so we may not be able to stray too far from our homes, but at least within the vicinity of our homes, if we've got access to a garden or a park or something, we can at least absorb a bit of the sunshine, build up our vitamin D reserves, and have a good time.
Yeah, it's been glorious weather these last few weeks. It's been a very, very lovely spring weather. It's just a shame that everybody's been locked indoors. I guess people in the countryside, they've been able to get out and about. And of course, we are going to have to talk a little bit about the coronavirus today. And I believe somebody of some importance that was a bit of a greatest Briton has actually passed away, Max. Do you want to just tell us about that before we go any further?
Well, it was just announced on the news earlier on today. In fact, yesterday it was announced on the news that Stirling Moss had unfortunately died. Now, a lot of younger people may not actually know who Stirling Moss was, but people of my generation will know of Stirling Moss and of older generations. He was a really a lion of a man in terms of British motor racing. He won countless numbers of races here within the UK, but then also raced in during the formative years of Formula One. And although he never won the world title, and he's, you know, quite often referred to as the greatest British motor racing driver that never won a world title, he did during the period, I think, between about 1957 and 63, something of that sort. He did. He either came second or he came third in I think it was seven consecutive years, and on one occasion missing the world championship by just a single point. And so he was a great racing driver. He raced cars during the period when the technology was nowhere near as great as it is today. Where the aerodynamics of the cars was nothing like as sophisticated as it is today. The cars were sort of fairly rudimentary in terms of their aerodynamics. And a lot of the cars weren't anything like as reliable as they are today. And so some of the reasons why he failed to win world championships were because the cars, unfortunately, at the time broke down and things of that sort. So he was just very unlucky in that respect. But he also took part in a number of land speed record challenges. I think he was a driver for Jaguar, and in the sort of mid 50s he achieved a speed record for the first car to, I think it was, travel over 100 miles over 100 miles an hour or something of that sort, and he competed in things of this sort, and so he was a very competitive chap, and he was honored by being made an OBE and lived to a ripe old age, really, because he died at the age of 90, and that's quite amazing when you consider that one of the accidents that put him out of motor racing eventually was a very, very serious crash where he crashed at over 120 miles an hour, and where he, as a result of that crash, was in a coma for a month. And to come out of a coma after a month and then live so many years beyond that, and to regain all of his faculties as well, it was an amazing feat of recovery, if nothing else. So it's just very sad that he's died. And he's the sort of person, I think, that years gone by would have been admired by lots and lots of people.
And it wasn't a coronavirus, was it? I think it was natural causes. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, it was natural causes, I think, yes.
Yeah, Tim Brooke Taylor from the Goodies has died of coronavirus, and they were always quite patriotic. Yeah, I've heard of Stirling Moss, but a bit before my time, but he's certainly made a good name for Britain, I would suggest. taking part in motor racing like that and being the first to achieve those land speed records. Well, to get back into the coronavirus topics today, it seems that rather more than were to be expected of non-whites are falling prey to this disease. Now, I talked about this a little bit on Friday, and it was a bit of a satirical episode, but it's now being taken very, very seriously, particularly over here in Britain. There's actually calls for a government investigation into this. The head of the British Medical Association has called on the government to investigate if and why black, Asian and minority ethnic people are more likely to die from coronavirus. The first 10 doctors to die in the UK from COVID-19 were all black and minority ethnic, with ancestry from regions including Asia, the Middle East and Africa. Although black and minority ethnic staff make up 44% of medical personnel in the NHS, Dr. Chand Nagpal said the fact that all who have died were from ethnic minorities was extremely disturbing. Now, this is interesting because a while back, the head of the World Health Organization told us that we were not to identify the people that had this virus by their ethnicity. He said this is the one thing we mustn't do, is identify the Chinese as having the coronavirus or identify the Italians as having the coronavirus. And yet that all seems to have been forgotten now that it seems to be affecting black and minority ethnics more than anybody else. And the fact that it is disturbing, but why is this? And of course they're trying to blame white people for this. Labour have also called for an inquiry.
But what it also shows really is that Dr. Chand Nagpal is preoccupied with a social construct, isn't he? Rather than actually reporting on something that's a reality, and I'm saying all this in parentheses and inverted commas, so rather than report upon something that is a reality, he's reporting upon something which is a social construct, because it's only as a result of the fact that he is labouring under the misapprehension of a social construct in parentheses that he's even noticed that the first 10 doctors to die of COVID-19 are all members of ethnic minority groups.
It's a double standard once again. And of course, you do have to wonder if the fact that he is actually a part of that ethnic group may also be why he finds it extremely disturbing. And of course, he is the head of the British Medical Association, is this Indian guy. So, I mean, it may mean that he is more likely to get this, but if it was just a social construct, then why would it matter? Well, Labour have also called for an inquiry into why a disproportionate number of people who have died from coronavirus come from ethnic minority communities. Shadow Equalities Secretary Marsha Dukadova said the disproportionate number of black, Asian and minority ethnic doctors who had died was deeply disturbing. She added, it reflects the shocking underlying inequalities facing black and minority ethnic communities as a whole, who are disproportionately represented in the numbers of people getting the virus. The government must urgently investigate why black and minority ethnic communities are more vulnerable to this virus. Well, what reason could there be that they are more vulnerable to this virus? There are quite a few reasons. It could be because they haven't actually learned to speak English, so they haven't understood the warnings. It could be that they haven't believed the warnings. It could be that they are still congregating and refusing to socially distance. And listeners will probably remember, 2 or 3 weeks back, I pointed out that black and minority ethnics were ignoring the advice to socially distance, and I predicted that there would be more numbers of them that were actually in the hospitals than white people. And of course, this has come true. And we can also, I mean, some people might say, well, this is all based in London at the moment, and London is very, very multicultural. But it's not just happening in Britain, it's also happening in America. In America, they're getting twice as many blacks turning up at the hospitals with COVID-19 than their percentage of the population. I think in Chicago, it's something like 70% of all of them. And they're talking today on the news about it being 2/3 of all the people that have got this virus are black and minority ethnic. And the fact that this shadow equality secretary is saying that this reflects shocking underlying inequalities facing these communities. I mean, she's trying to find some way of blaming the white man for this. And of course, they've been talking about how black people don't have large enough houses. They all have to live together. They have problems with obesity and all of these things. I mean, it's not the white man's fault, is it? If we haven't built them big enough houses, they're the ones responsible for renting a house or for buying a house and obesity. If they eat too much, they may have these comorbidities. But they're still looking at some way of actually blaming white people for this. Do you want to make a comment on that, Max?
Well, what I would say is that there are lots of working class white people, both in the United States and also in Britain, who haven't succumbed to the virus. What I would say is that, we spoke last week, didn't we, about the alarmist sort of articles that had featured in the in Jewish publications claiming that Jews were disproportionately affected by the coronavirus. And the point I made there is that the numbers were actually still quite small and they weren't really representative numbers. And it wouldn't have taken very much for such a small survey to be distorted. And I expressed the view at the time that some point on further on into the spread of the virus, these numbers would even themselves out, and so the number of Jews suffering from the coronavirus would eventually become the same as the number of the proportion of non-Jews. And in fact, that seems to have been borne out, because what's happened is that the number of cases of people with being diagnosed with coronavirus and the number of people dying from coronavirus has increased over the course of the last 7 days, unfortunately. But what it has done, it has tended to rectify that apparent disparity between the two death rates. And so now, as far as the death rates for Jews are concerned, they don't really stand out as being any different from the death rate of people in society generally. What I would say, though, is that it's quite likely that there are some racially based or genetically based, however you want to call it, greater susceptibilities amongst certain groups. And I would say that this almost certainly is going to be a factor in this. And this is something that doctors and scientists really need to just recognize, that the coronavirus is making their assertions that race is a social construct. They're making that assertion appear absurd, because the whole basis of their complaint is that they have seen people who most definitely aren't just a figment of a social construct becoming ill at a disproportionately higher rate than the rest of the population. So I would guess that despite the fact that the numbers seem to have evened themselves out where, as far as Jews are concerned, the fact that there is this considerably greater bias, I would say, in terms of the number of people suffering from coronavirus, would tend to suggest that there is some kind of genetically based or racially based greater susceptibility amongst people who are members of ethnic minorities. And this could be down to a number of things. I mean, one of the statistics I can remember researching many years ago was the incidence of TB, because TB had for many, many years here in the UK been completely eliminated in the post-war period. And then as mass immigration began to rise, we found that the incidence of TB became increasingly common, and it was mainly amongst immigrants from the Indian subcontinent, where TB apparently has traditionally been rife. And so what I would imagine, just based on this, and it remains to be seen, it remains for it to be proven one way or the other, is that there is probably a larger proportion of people from the Indian subcontinent who have got some kind of scarring of their lungs as a result of having suffered TB as a child in their home country, or having suffered TB as a child when they even after they'd entered the UK, and that would then give them a greater susceptibility to infections like the coronavirus. And so that perhaps would partially explain it. But there also are other things related to breathing, where there is a much higher incidence of people of Negro extraction, of them suffering breathing difficulties when they're being arrested and restrained by the police. And so it just occurs to me that in view of the fact that, you know, there have been complaints over the years about people of Negro extraction who have suffocated while they're being restrained by the police. And these complaints have always been on the basis that, you know, the police were being additionally heavy-handed in terms of their restraint of the victims in these cases. But the fact of the matter is, it could well be that there is some kind of a physical difference in the airways of Negroes, which makes them more susceptible to ailments related to breathing difficulty. And so, and just as a large number of them have appear to have died under arrest, it could well be that that also makes them more susceptible to the coronavirus as well. So it is a very interesting thing, and it would be nice if the scientific community and the medical community just set aside for one moment their desire to appear politically correct and just actually investigated what's going on from a completely objective standpoint, without worrying about whether or not the result they were going to come out with might be perceived as being racist or not. They just did it on a purely scientific basis. That would be a really good thing.
It would indeed, and that's a good point that you bring up there, Max. And I would suggest that maybe it could be because they have smaller lungs. We do know that they have smaller chest cavities, and this is one of the reasons why they're not so good at swimming, because they haven't got so much air in their chest when they're actually in the water. And that is a biological fact. It could be that. It also may be behavioural. Just at this time, we hear that in India, the explosion in coronavirus cases there has been caused by Muslims. Of course, the BBC are reporting this as, oh, it's hate speech. The Indians are hate speaking about the Muslims by saying it's the Muslims that are spreading this. And then in the same news report, they tell us, and it originates in a Muslim mission that all caught coronavirus and then spread it all around India. So it is actually the Muslims that have got it in India. And of course, the Muslims and the Hindus are both the same ethnicity. They just have a different religion. So it could be cultural. We've also had a study recently that they did, which didn't actually have that large a sample group. It was only 8 people in the sample group, but they actually found that the Chinese were most susceptible to getting this disease. And white people and blacks weren't so susceptible. And what they were looking at was the ACE2 receptor, which is how the coronavirus actually makes its way into the body. And this is a quote from the study itself. We noticed that the only Asian donor, male, had a much higher ACE2 expressing cell ratio than white and African American donors. He actually had 2.50% versus 0.47% of all cells. So what that's saying is that white people and African Americans both only had a fifth of these receptors in their lungs than the Chinese do. They say this might explain the observation that the new coronavirus pandemic and previous SARS-CoV pandemic are concentrated in the Asian area. In addition, the distribution of ACE2 is also more widespread in male donors than females. At least 5 different types of cells in the male lung express this receptor, while only 2 to 4 types of cells in the female lung express the receptor. This result is highly consistent with the epidemic investigation showing that most of the confirmed 2019 nCoV-infected patients were men. And that study came out in January 2020. So they really need to do more research into this, into the biological or ethnic component of it. But of course, all the while you've got the head of the World Health Organization saying we shouldn't be identifying people by ethnicity because it leads to stigmatization. We are not going to find out. But of course, now that it is these large numbers that we're getting here, 2/3 of the victims, both in Britain and in America, are black and minority ethnic. They're being forced to look into it. Well, Dr. Nagpal told The Guardian, at face value, it seems hard to see how this can be random, to have the first 10 doctors all being of black and minority ethnic background. Not only that, we also know that in terms of the black and minority ethnic population, they make up about a third of those in intensive care. And we've been told today it's now two-thirds of intensive care. As well as the 10 doctors, 3 out of 6 nurses who died from the virus were black and minority ethnic, as was a hospital pharmacist and at least one healthcare assistant. Now, we've suggested ways that this could be down to biology, but there are also ways that this could be just down to them themselves. And I've got 2 articles here. The first one's from 2012. 3 out of 4 doctors struck off the medical register this year were trained abroad, figures show. It means that those who qualified overseas were over 5 times more likely to be struck off than British graduates. The data comes amidst growing alarm that many foreign doctors are simply not up to scratch and putting the safety of patients at risk. And then we can look 5 years later, April 2017. Doctors who qualified in Bangladesh are 13 times more likely to be incompetent, shocking figures show. University College London researchers also found Egyptian and Nigerian-born GPs face an 8-fold higher risk of being investigated for their actions, Iraqis 7 times, and Indians 5 times. However, writing in the journal BMC Medical Education, experts remain adamant that doctors are reliable, regardless of where they are from. And of course, that flies in the face of these statistics, where actually we find that foreign doctors are a lot more incompetent than native-born doctors. So it could just be that these doctors that they've got there, they are actually incompetent. And one of them, who died, in the report they had it on him on Friday, they said that he was only wearing gloves with the coronavirus patient. And they were sort of implying that this was the government's fault for not providing the PPE. But surely he would have known that he needed to wear a mask. Surely he would have been able to get a mask from somewhere, even if he had to purchase it himself. And you're not going to take that risk. I mean, if he did take that risk, and he knew he needed a mask and he didn't wear a mask, again, that's incompetence. He caused his own death, basically.
I know of lots of nurses here in the UK who have, because there have been shortages of the protective equipment, they've bought their own masks and bought their own gowns and things because that they've just been so worried about it. So, you know, even out of the relatively small salaries that the nurses have, the most sensible nurses have actually taken the step of buying their own protective equipment, which any sensible person would do. And if a doctor on a relatively high salary compared to a nurse doesn't have the wit to buy a face mask or is perhaps so arrogant as to assume that they wouldn't actually get the virus and carried on working without using protective equipment, then you can see how that might affect them or make them more vulnerable as well. And we've only got to look also at politicians, because we've had over the course of the last week or so, we've had the Chief Medical Officer for Scotland, Dr. Calderwood, and we've had the Cabinet Minister, Robert Jenrick, who's the Housing Secretary, both of whom have been shamed by the police for breaking their own social distancing rules. And by driving to second homes that are some considerable distance from the home that they normally occupy during their working week. And I'm not going to sort of talk about the relative merits or pros and cons of whether what they did was right or not. It was certainly wrong in the sense that it gave out a mixed message. But what it does show is that even at the highest levels of government, there are people who appear to flout the rules that they specify for the rest of us to follow in order to keep us all safe. And so it's quite likely that senior doctors as well might also suffer from the same kind of arrogance.
Oh, we mustn't remember that. We mustn't forget that Boris Johnson proudly told us that he had been walking around a ward full of COVID-19 patients and shook all their hands on March the 3rd. Did he wash his hands afterwards? Was he wearing a mask? I would suggest that that was actually what gave him the disease. And we've also had last weekend, there was a Labour MP that was at a Muslim funeral along with 100 other Muslims, all close together. So it could be down to behaviour. It could be down to something biological. We're not sure yet. But the overall death figures in the UK have not been broken down by ethnicity. But early research published this week showed that 35% of almost 2,000 patients in intensive care units were non-white. Now, as I say, over the weekend, they've upgraded that to two-thirds of the patients. Dr. Nagpal said black and minority health professionals are concerned about the deaths of their colleagues and what it might mean for them. The BMA chair said it might be too early to get firm answers, but that it needed to be investigated. He mused as to whether black and minority ethnic doctors felt less able to complain about inadequate personal protective equipment. Black and minority ethnic doctors often feel bullied and harassed at higher levels compared to their white counterparts, he said. Well, they may claim that, but I doubt very much whether they are bullied and harassed. They have special diversity and equalities commissioners in the NHS just to make sure that black and minority ethnic doctors don't feel bullied or harassed. And they have all these programs to prevent them, to try and stop them actually being taken to task for their incompetence, because they've said these numbers of foreign doctors that are being struck off for incompetence just isn't good enough. It must be down to some kind of institutional racism. So they've got all these programs in place now to actually, you know, cover up the difficulties that some of these foreign doctors have. And of course, what he's really trying to do here is just trying to blame white people for this. And I think they're going to have some difficulty in doing that. They've been doing the same in America. They've recently been having a go at the Surgeon General there for pointing out that the blacks need to stop smoking, stop drinking, and stop taking drugs and stop eating so much, because these are the reasons why it's those sort of things that lead to complications. And the black community over there do happen to do more than the average of all of that. And it was actually the black Surgeon General that was saying this. And he was accused of being a white supremacist for saying it. So
I think the rates of obesity amongst blacks in North America are significantly higher than they are amongst the white community. The rates of type 2 diabetes also, and heart disease and things of that sort. So and it's often argued that it's because people from ethnic minorities are not as adapted to eating the food that white people eat, that then makes them more susceptible to these diseases, with heart disease and type 2 diabetes following on from being obese anyway. And it's kind of like implying that white diets are traditionally very high in calories, and that people from ethnic minorities are not used to this, and so therefore that's why they become obese. But again, that's that again is pointing to a biological difference, a genetic difference, a racially based difference in terms of the susceptibility that people have to certain diseases, which again I would suggest ought to be prompting the medical researchers and scientists into conducting some sort of research into these areas and publishing the statistics in a way which is purely science-based and not curbed or suppressed by political correctness, so that we can all understand that there are larger differences between the various racial groups in the world than just culture would suggest, and that there obviously are racial differences that are real things, which means that the concept of race is a real concept and not just a social construct.
Well, there's more of them that get this disease, and there's also more of them in the prisons as well. And of course, there being more of them in the prisons, they blame white racism. So that's what they're going to look for to blame this on. And you do have to ask yourself why nobody called for an investigation when they discovered that actually white people got more pneumonia than anybody else, more pneumonia than their percentage of the population. And there wasn't an investigation that was called into that. But of course, we'll have to keep following this. And again, I will say I predicted this three weeks back, after looking at the behavior of the blacks and minority ethnics in the multicultural areas and how they were ignoring all the social distancing rules. They weren't wearing masks. They weren't using hand sanitizer. They most of the time they were just not even believing what they were being told. And I did predict that because of their behavior, we were going to see a lot more of them than their percentage of the population. And also among the Muslim community, where they were saying that Allah will look out for us. It's all Allah's will. We have to go to the mosque. You can't shut these mosques down. And of course, we know that the Muslims have, when the mosques have been shut down, they've still been meeting up, hundreds of them meeting up on tennis courts and in parks, and so they can still all pray together. So you have got this cultural side to it, a behavioral side to it, but there may also be this biological side. We'll just have to keep monitoring the situation, I guess. I guess we could move on. Should we move on to our greatest Britons now, Max? Or do you want to add anything else to that?
I think we can safely move on. I think we've aired that subject fairly well.
Okay, well, we're going to get back into talking about Æthelflæd, the Lady of the Mercians, who was born 870 AD and died 12th of June 918. And last week we talked about how we knew that she was important because she barely appears in the Saxon Chronicle. And the fact that she appears in Irish records and Mercian records, that tells us that she's fairly important, especially to make it over there into the Irish records. We talked about her rescuing the relics of the saint from the Danelaw. We talked about the Mercian revival, which was like the Alfredian revival, a revival in learning and religiosity. And we talked about how Æthelflæd became the de facto ruler while her husband was still alive, because he was fairly ill. And we had a discussion about her being queen and about the fact that she wasn't actually referred to as queen. And I brought up a story that was in the life of Alfred, which explained why the Saxons refused to have a queen over them. And it's quite an interesting story. As I say, it's from the life of King Alfred the Great that was written by Bishop Asser, who came from Wales. And one of the interesting parts about it is that it implies that the Welsh didn't have this tradition, because they thought it was quite a strange tradition, Bishop Asser did. And of course, the Welsh had Boadicea, but the Saxons didn't actually have any queens. And you were looking into this as well, Max, and you discovered that there weren't any until quite later on. I mean, what was it you were saying? When was it the first time that they actually had another queen after this?
Well, from Boadicea, you've got to go all the way through to, I think it was a Queen Jane, just prior to Bloody Mary, and then Elizabeth I. And I think that Jane, Lady Jane Grey, I think it was. I think she reigned for just 9 days before she died, or was replaced, because she was born during a period of political upheaval following the death of Henry VIII, and then Mary I, who became Bloody Mary, she acceded to the throne, but she then married the King of Spain, and so she ruled England in partnership with him. And then after her death, it was Elizabeth I who then became the next monarch who ruled as a queen on her own, effectively. So between Boadicea and Elizabeth I, Æthelflæd was the only English, she would have been Mercian or Anglo-Saxon queen to have existed throughout that entire period of what must have been something like 1300 years. And so that sort of sets her apart as a woman of unique qualities and unique ability. The fact that she, and despite the fact that she's not mentioned very much in the Saxon Chronicle, she is mentioned as Lady of the Mercians in the Mercian Chronic version of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and she's also referred to as the Queen, and she's also referred to as the Queen in Welsh texts of the time as well. So she was regarded as a queen, and the history of her reign shows that she controlled the armies and she directed her soldiers, etc., and was a warrior queen in the same kind of mold as Boadicea and Elizabeth I.
So it would have been almost 1,000 years then between the Lady of Mercia and Jane, Queen Jane. That was
More than 1,000 years, I would have thought.
Well, we'll start with, as I say, this is reading from Asser's Life of King Alfred the Great, and this is part 13, Judith's position in Wessex, and this is actually talking about Alfred's father's wife, Ethelwulf. When Ethelwulf, therefore, returned from Rome, the whole nation, as was fitting, so rejoiced in the arrival of their ruler that, if he had allowed them, they would have expelled his unruly son Ethelbald with all his counsellors from the kingdom. That's because his son Ethelbald had mistreated them all. But he, as I have said, acting with great clemency and prudent counsel, would not act in this way, lest the kingdom should be exposed to peril. He likewise bade Judith, daughter of King Charles, whom he had received from her father, take her seat by his own side on the royal throne, without any dispute or enmity from his nobles, even to the end of his life, although contrary to the perverse custom of that nation. For the nation of the West Saxons does not allow the queen to sit beside the king, nor to be called queen, but only the king's wife, which refusal, or rather reproach, the chief persons of that land say arose from a certain headstrong and malevolent queen of the nation, who did all things so contrary to her lord and to the whole people, that not only did the hatred which she brought upon herself bring to pass her exclusion from the queenly throne, but also entailed the same corruption upon those who came after her ever since. In consequence of the extreme malignity of that queen, all the inhabitants of the land banded themselves together by an oath, never in their lives to let any king reign over them who should bid his queen take her seat on the royal throne by his side. And because, as I think, it is not known to many whence this perverse and detestable custom first arose in Wessex, contrary to the custom of all the Germanic peoples, it seems to me right to explain it a little more fully, as I have heard it from my lord Alfred the Truth-Teller, king of the Anglo-Saxons, who often told me about it, as he also had heard it from many men of truth who related the fact, or I should rather say expressly preserved the remembrance of it. And I find that interesting because, you know, this is the guy writing Alfred's autobiography for the Saxons, and he's calling their custom perverse and detestable. And, you wouldn't expect that. But, and that shows you that the Britons didn't go along with this custom, but it was very, very ingrained in amongst the Saxons. And King Charles, that it says here, I think that was Charlemagne that actually gave his daughter to King Alfred's father. It was King Alfred's mother. Do you want to comment on any of that at all, Max?
No. I think it's all fairly self-explanatory.
Okay, well, we'll move on to the next section. Offa and Edeburh. There was in Mercia in recent times a certain valiant king who was dreaded by all the neighbouring kings and states. His name was Offa, and it was he who had the great dike made from sea to sea between Wales and Mercia. His daughter, named Edeburh, was married to Beortric, king of the West Saxons. The moment she had possessed herself of the king's goodwill, and practically the whole power of the realm, she began to live tyrannically, after the manner of her father. Every man whom Beortric loved, she would execrate, and would do all things hateful to God and man, accusing to the king all whom she could, thus depriving them insidiously either of life or of power. And if she could not obtain the king's consent, she used to take them off by poison, as is ascertained to have been the case with a certain young man beloved by the king, whom she poisoned, seeing that she could not accuse him to the king. It is said, moreover, that King Beortric unwittingly tasted of this poison, though the queen had intended to give it not to him, but to the young man. The king, however, was beforehand with him, and so both perished. So she actually ended up killing the king. She was such a horrible, horrible witch. It doesn't end there, though. We get Edeburh's further life. King Beortric, therefore being dead, the queen, since she could no longer remain among the Saxons, sailed beyond the sea with countless treasures and came to Charles, king of the Franks. As she stood before the dais, bringing many gifts to the king, Charles said to her, "Choose, Edeburh, between me and my son, who stands with me on this dais." She, without deliberation, foolishly replied, "If I am to have my choice, I choose your son, because he is younger than you." At which Charles smiled and answered, "If you had chosen me, you should have had my son. But since you have chosen him, you shall have neither me nor him." However, he did give her a large convent of nuns, in which, having laid aside her secular habit and assumed the dress worn by the nuns, she discharged the office of abbess for a few years. As she is said to have lived irrationally in her own country, so she appears to have acted much more so among a foreign people, for being finally caught in illicit intercourse with a man of her own nation, she was expelled from the monastery by the order of King Charles. Henceforward, she lived a life of shame in poverty and misery until her death, so that at last, accompanied only by one slave, as I have heard from many who saw her, she begged her bread daily at Pavia, and so wretchedly died. I think it's an interesting tale, and I think that may be the origin of the phrase age before beauty. Do you think maybe age before beauty? Because that's what she's saying.
Interesting story.
But that's the moral of the story, isn't it? You know, she chose beauty before age. I mean, people always say age goes before beauty. I mean, it's just like a common phrase. And because she chose beauty instead, because she chose his son, she lost everything. Whereas if she had said him, like the age, she would have been given the beauty anyway. He would have given his son to marry. But that's the reason why the Saxons refused to have a queen. And that custom must have gone on, as we were saying, that must have gone on for a thousand years. Almost a thousand years.
Which again sort of shows what an exceptional person Æthelflæd must have been to have persuaded him to overcome that.
Very much so, very much so. Well, let's get back to the story of Æthelflæd herself, and we'll go back to 902. At this time, according to the three fragments, the Norse Vikings were expelled from Dublin and then made an abortive attack on Wales. When this failed, they applied to Æthelflæd, her husband being ill, for permission to settle near Chester. Æthelflæd agreed, and for some time they were peaceful. The Norse Vikings then joined with the Danes in an attack on Chester, but this failed because Æthelflæd had fortified the town, and she and her husband persuaded the Irish among the attackers to change sides. Other sources confirm that the Norse were driven out of Dublin in 902, and that Æthelflæd fortified Chester in 907. Æthelflæd refounded Chester as a burgh, and she is believed to have enhanced its Roman defences by running walls from the northwest and southeast corners of the fort to the River Dee. Simon Ward, who excavated an Anglo-Saxon site in Chester, sees the later prosperity of the town as owing much to the planning of Æthelflæd and Edward. So these three fragments, they must have come from Ireland, and this must be why the Irish have got records of this, because they kicked the Vikings out and they went to Æthelflæd, and then they broke their oath and they tried to invade Chester, and only they failed, and Æthelflæd managed to put them down, and also with the help of the Irish among them who changed sides.
Yes.
So he must have been very diplomatic, and they must have known, there must have been a more powerful force as well for the Irish to say, look, we're going to change and we're going to support the Saxons instead of the Norse.
One of the things you learn from this is just what a turbulent period politically that was in English history or British history. A very, very turbulent period with people changing sides and all sorts of alliances growing up, all sorts of tribal groupings all trying to find their place and expand their area of influence.
Now, once they had expanded their area of influence, the important thing was to build up these fortifications. You know, they weren't sort of sitting on their laurels. It was because she built up the Roman defences in Chester that they were able to defeat these Vikings. And Alfred had actually built a network of fortified boroughs, and in the 910s, Edward and Æthelflæd embarked on a program of extending them, which would stand her in good stead in later years when attacked by the Norsemen. Among the towns where she built defences were Wednesbury, Bridgnorth, Tamworth, Stafford, Warwick, Cherbury, and Runcorn. So she went on quite a building spree there. Do you want to comment on these boroughs and these defences that she built?
Well, I think it's a reflection, really, that both Edward and Æthelflæd continued Alfred's policy and shared his outlook, which was that the times for raiding and stealing wealth from other people were over, and that if nations or if peoples and communities wanted to be wealthy, then they needed peace. And they needed peace so that they could trade and so that they could grow crops, etc., in order to build their wealth, and that it was necessary for them to pay a price for that peace by paying taxes to a monarch who would then have an army sufficient to keep the other raiding tribes at bay. And so this is really the period during which there would have been the formation of the notion of noblesse oblige on the part of the monarchs, where there would have been a kind of unwritten pact between the people and the monarch, that the people would pay taxes in order to keep the monarch in great luxury, and in return for that great luxury, the monarch would therefore be beyond the bribery of hostile peoples, and would in return for that that wealth would then devote themselves and their families to the defense of the nation, and would be prepared to give their lives in defense of the nation, and so it was a pact between monarchy or between aristocracy and the people.
Interesting to see that they're carrying on Alfred's vision as well, and carrying on with the process he developed of building up these defences and educating the people, and as you say, taking taxes from them to pay for the standing army and for the fortifications. Yep. In 917, invasions by three Viking armies failed when Æthelflæd sent an army to capture Derby and the territory around it. The town was one of the five boroughs of the Danelaw, together with Leicester, Lincoln, Nottingham, and Stamford. Derby was the first to fall to the English, but she lost four of her thanes, who were dear to her, in the battle. Tim Clarkson, who describes Æthelflæd as a renowned and competent war leader, regards the victory at Derby as her greatest triumph. At the end of the year, the East Anglian Danes would submit to Edward, her brother. So do you think here that she would go in there and attack, and then they would submit to her brother rather than to her? Was that the sort of process that was going on here?
I think it's fairly clear that Æthelflæd and Edward the Elder worked as a kind of a partnership. You know, in the same way that her husband, Æthelred, had accepted the overlordship of Alfred, I think that Æthelflæd probably recognized that she would need to ultimately bow to the overlordship of her brother, but because of the great partnership they had between the two of them, she was allowed by Edward to continue to exercise the powers of a monarch in Mercia, and they worked as a partnership. So she would have applied pressure on them, and it perhaps just so happened that it was Edward that delivered the final blow that caused the Danes to submit. But it could well just have been that I would imagine that Edward would have been applying the pressure and that they may have submitted to Æthelflæd had things been slightly different.
Yeah, I mean, they might have found it a bit embarrassing submitting to a woman. I mean, they're being defeated by a woman here. And don't forget, I mean, three Viking armies failed when Æthelflæd's army kicked their ass, basically. I mean, that is quite a failure there to be defeated by this woman's army. And don't forget, it was all started by these armies invading Æthelflæd's area. But in early 918, Æthelflæd gained possession of Leicester without opposition, and most of the local Danish army submitted to her. A few months later, the leading men of Danish-ruled York offered to pledge their loyalty to Æthelflæd, probably to secure her support against Norse raiders from Ireland. But she died on the 12th of June 918 before she could take advantage of the offer. No similar offer is known to have been made to Edward. According to the three fragments, in 918, Æthelflæd led an army of Scots and Northumbrian English against forces led by the Norse Viking leader Ragnall at the Battle of Corbridge in Northumbria. Historians consider this unlikely, but she may have sent a contingent to the battle. Both sides claimed victory, but Ragnall was able to establish himself as ruler of Northumbria. In the three fragments, Æthelflæd also formed a defensive alliance with the Scots and the Strathclyde British, a claim accepted by Clarkson. So she actually managed to get the whole of the Danelaw. They all pledged their loyalty to her, and then she died. And then I believe that it was actually Edward that took those lands after they had been pledged to Æthelflæd. Is that correct, Max?
Yeah, I believe so. So Edward then became the monarch of all of England apart from Northumbria. And it was then for his son Æthelstan who inherited, well, he didn't directly inherit the throne. There was another brother who was in between, but Æthelstan eventually became the king of Wessex and a claimant of the throne of all England, but who then fought with the Northumbrians and eventually forced them to submit, and so therefore became the first king of England.
She must have had a really formidable reputation. I mean, Leicester is just submitting to her without any opposition. And then a couple of months later, York pledges their loyalty to her. And I mean, all she's actually done is fought this one battle for Derby. And then the reputation of that was so much that these other Danes just surrendered to her, basically.
I think to some extent these sort of things follow the same course that is followed when you play Monopoly. If you play Monopoly, once somebody starts to win, it then becomes far more likely that they're going to win because they just have the greater resources, and it kind of creates a snowball effect. And I think that she would have had the early victories, and then as a result of those victories, she would have enlisted the survivors, even the enemy survivors from the previous battles would have been enlisted into her armies, and her army would then just have snowballed in terms of size, and she would have then would have appeared incredibly formidable to any of the fragments that of the British Isles that were still trying to resist English authority or the authority of the English throne.
I think there's some. Also, it seems to me that it's the winner is the one who's the first to team up, because if you look at this, you've got the Danes are fighting against the Norse. You've got Norsemen from Ireland that are invading the Danes, and they're fighting amongst themselves, whereas the Saxons are joining up together. And in the history of the kings of Britain, when Geoffrey of Monmouth writes about at the end, he writes about the reasons why the British failed to defeat the Saxons, and he says it's because the British failed to team up together. They were still fighting amongst one another, as well as fighting against the Saxons, but the Saxons weren't so prone to fighting amongst themselves. And you've got the same thing here. You've got the Danes that are fighting among themselves, and you've got the Saxons that have teamed up, and then you get the Danes wanting to join the winning side, and they join up with with the Saxons. There's a lot of praise. There's a lot of praise for Æthelflæd. She is praised by Anglo-Norman chroniclers such as William of Malmesbury, who described her as a powerful accession to Edward's party, the delight of his subjects and the dread of his enemies, a woman of enlarged soul. And according to Pauline Stafford, like Elizabeth I, she became a wonder to later ages. In Nick Higham's view, medieval and modern writers have been so captivated by her that her brother Edward's reputation has suffered unfairly in comparison. I'll just stop there. Where he mentions a woman of enlarged soul, I think that's referring to her piety. When she went and rescued the saints' relics, and they built churches, and they gave land to the churches, and she was following in her father's footsteps there, of being very religious, whilst at the same time being this warrior queen. Do you want to make a comment there, Max?
Yeah, perhaps you could interpret it that the word soul could mean vigor, and she could just be seen as a woman who was a ball of energy, who didn't balk at anything, who was determined, and who determined and unafraid. You know, that same kind of connotation. That sort of connotation could be put on that statement. But it sounds as though both were probably true. And just going back to your previous point with regard to the Saxons working together, I think that it was the partnership between Æthelflæd, who was queen of the Mercians, and Edward the Elder, who was the king of Wessex, that meant that they didn't have to defend their own border, the border between the two of them, which then meant that they would proportionately, for a kingdom of the size that they were, they therefore had more men to place at the actual hostile borders, which meant that when they then encountered their hostile enemies, they had more troops and therefore more likely to win. And again, sorry to sort of refer back to another board game, but in my youth, I've played lots of board games to what I would regard as quite a high standard. But a lot of people will be familiar with the board game Risk. With Risk, once you start to build an empire, if you form an alliance with somebody else so that you don't have to defend the border between your two empires, it then always creates a winning alliance, and you then sort of battle through till it's just the two of you left in the board game, and then you just fight each other for who's going to actually win the game. But if you get two powerful kingdoms that are side by side and they form an alliance such they don't have to defend their internal border, that is a success factor in terms of statecraft.
Well, they didn't have to defend the border against Wales either. I mean, you think about it. I mean, you got Alfred that united the Wessex and united the Saxons, and also he was on good terms with the Welsh. Don't forget, it was Bishop Asser from Wales that was writing the life of King Alfred, and it tells us in that the Welsh went to him for protection. So he's got all of southern England. He's got southern Wales. And then they've got Mercia as well, and it's just this Danelaw bit in the north of England that they needed to take, so they had the whole of England and Wales, and then they could start forming this national feeling amongst the English and the Welsh, and eventually the Scots as well. And this was the first bit where they really had the whole of England, and you got this feeling of the English being a nation. Æthelflæd is vitally important to the building of the English as a nation, basically, just as important as Alfred the Great, her father. The Irish, and go on.
And it's also interesting just how readily the kings of Ireland, the kings of Wales, or the lords in Wales, because they may not necessarily regard themselves as a kingdom, but the lords and the kings, the aristocrats in those areas, and also Scotland, how readily they formed alliances between each other, with an alliance between the Scots and some of the Irish and the armies under Æthelflæd and Edward to fighting against the Northumbrians. And so therefore what this actually demonstrates is that the schism that is quite often overemphasized in modern politics by people who try to promote Scottish nationalism and Irish nationalism and Welsh nationalism is actually a bit of a myth. And it's something that's actually a more recent invention than most people would think. Now, you'd have thought that the further back you go into antiquity, the greater would be the sense of nationhood amongst those peoples, and the greater would be the antipathy towards domination by England, as all the political domination that eventually came from England later on. But in reality, the opposite is the truth. The closer you get to modern times, the more emphasis is placed upon dividing the peoples of the British Isles by making the peripheral parts of the British Isles appear to be far more alienated from any sense of unity. And I think that's something that people need to understand, so that we can perhaps look forward to a time in future when the whole of the British Isles will be united under a single administration. And I think that would be the recipe that from a statecraft point of view, that would be most beneficial for all of the people of the British Isles.
I think the schism really began with Cromwell. I mean, he destroyed parts of Wales, he destroyed parts of Ireland, he killed the king, he banned Easter, I think he might have banned Christmas as well, smashed up churches, destroyed shrines. I mean, the man was just a total Bolshevik. He was just an absolute devil, Cromwell was. I mean, there are people still furious at Cromwell in Ireland today, there's still people furious at Cromwell in Wales today. Whereas when you go back further in time, and even before the building of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms and the alliances with the Welsh, before then, when you had the Britons, who then became the Welsh, when they were fighting against the Romans, they all united behind a Pendragon. And you hear of Arthur the Pendragon, and at the times that the island was facing, you know, invading armies, they would all unite together under one king, who was their battle king, basically. And once they managed to defeat them, then they would go back to having their singular kingships. Like after Julius Caesar was sent packing that first time, they went back to their singular kingships. But the earliest records that we have show that the peoples of England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales, they all got on well together. They didn't fight amongst themselves. They saw themselves as part of the same nation. And then it happened again after Æthelflæd and with the United Kingdom, but then it was damaged by Cromwell. That's the way that I see it anyway. I've got some more.
I would agree with that as a general principle. It's a great pity that subsequent English monarchs abused the power that the life's work of people like Æthelflæd and Edward the Elder gave them, and it would have been far better if they'd concern themselves with creating a nation throughout the entire British Isles.
Well, I think a lot of it was carrot rather than stick as well. I mean, if you read about King Alfred, a certain amount of money was put by so that anybody that visited the court, meaning, you know, foreign diplomats, Irish kings, princes from the continent, any of them turned up at the court, then they were lavished with gifts. You know, they could have whatever they wanted, so it wasn't you know, threatening them, you will be under my overlordship like Cromwell. It was more a question of competing as to who could give the greatest gifts. It was a very, very different way of doing things. So they must have been excellent diplomats. Æthelflæd must have been a very, very good diplomat, as well as a warrior. The Irish and Welsh annals described her as a queen, and the Annals of Ulster, which ignore the deaths of Alfred and Edward, and they describe her as renowned Saxon queen. So the Irish and the Welsh are still quite happy to call her a queen, but the Saxons, because of that tradition, they call her a Lady of Mercia. Pauline Stafford describes Æthelflæd as the last Mercian queen, referred to in charters in such terms as by the gift of Christ's mercy ruling the government of the Mercians. Well, the first and last, really. I mean, the kings all had wives, but they weren't actually referred to as queens. And I don't know of any that actually had a role like this, as in de facto ruler. But again, this tells us how important She was outside of England, outside of Britain. You know, this is the Annals of Ulster. So you're in Northern Ireland there. Do you want to add any more to that, Max?
No. I think we've ably demonstrated everything that people need to know. And I think that certainly in modern day education in schools, I would think that Æthelflæd probably doesn't get a mention. But I think that it's something that that we ought to encourage, and that's something that hopefully will be rectified, because I think that there are particularly individual women that have made a massive contribution to the formation and to the well-being of our nation, and that should be recognised.
I think if you're a nationalist, you should know your history, and you should know the important men and women of your history, and you should take inspiration from them. And that helps you to understand who you are and what your strengths are and your place in history, and give you a sense of not just being here living in the now, but actually part of a long chain that goes back into the past of great people. So I'm really enjoying this series. I know a lot of you listeners out there are enjoying it as well. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you. Even if you are in quarantine, it's still nice weather. We will see you again next Monday.